Hello and welcome to Heart Yoga Radio. Today we're going to do part three of our series Blue Pill or Red Pill. And today we want to talk about the metaphysical aspect of this idea. So, how does this differ from the approach that we were taking in the last episode?
The last one that we did was about existential aspects, I called it, of the blue pill, red pill scenario from the film The Matrix, in which Neo, the protagonist, is faced with the choice between taking a blue pill, which will send him back to sleep, or a red pill, which will wake him up to the truth and the truth of his situation. And we considered this under the rubric of existentialism. In other words, we tried to elucidate what Neo's lived experience of being faced with such a question, and to elucidate the nature of choice and the nature of the freedom which it enables people to choose. And this is something that plugged very well into certain aspects from Zen, but also certain aspects of Sartre and Kierkegaardian existentialism. So that's what we did there. So the main feature of that characterisation is its emphasis on felt lived experience, interiority almost, you might say. In this one, I want to take the metaphysical line and seek out resonances between the metaphysical aspects of the philosophical traditions and the scene in the film, the famous blue pill, red pill scene.
Which there will be a link to below in the write-up if you want to have a look at that.
Yeah, there's a 4-minute clip on YouTube. In fact, there's several of them, you can go and have a look. It's only 4 minutes, it's worth it. And it's, as we've mentioned before, it's bloody classic, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
It really is.
Yeah.
Absolutely splendid. Just as a piece of cinema.
Yeah.
It's really wonderful. I could kind of keep watching it. So, the big question is, well, what am I talking about? What do I mean by metaphysics?
Good place to start.
Yeah, metaphysics is one of those words. It's actually one of those words that's kind of got hijacked, like so many words these days. Now, if you go into a bookshop and look for the metaphysics section, and you'll find a load of stuff about like tarot cards and how to magically influence your fate. You know, the kind of stuff that we've talked about a few times on these podcasts. You know, how to draw in good things and all this kind of crap. And the word metaphysics has come to mean just basically like new age irrationality, really.
Oh, that's a shame.
Yeah, it has. In philosophy, I think you can trace at least 5 different meanings of the word as well. So it had already gone on holiday ages ago, that term, metaphysics. The way I'm using it here is to do with the attempt made by philosophers on and off over time, over thousands of years, to characterise the whole of existence, or as Heidegger put it, you know, the being of beings as a whole. You're trying to give an answer to the question, life, the universe and everything. It has that kind of overarching, totalising attempt. And I tend to use the word metaphysics in that sense, you know, these totalising attempts to explain everything about human life and about existence itself. And therefore, also about very fundamental matters of truth and inference and so on. Yeah. So, it's all the big stuff is the thing that's going on there. You can see from that characterisation of metaphysics as being about the big stuff, the archetypal metaphysics is Platonism, the idea that the truth of life, the universe and everything is something that's hidden behind or above or possibly inside our ordinary reality. But it is an illusion, a truth illusion system. And you tend to get this with metaphysics, you know, as soon as one attempts to kind of look a bit deeper, as it were, you get the feeling that there's another universe, there's a deeper reality. Of course, in Platonism, this is the world of the forms, the empyrean, the world of the forms, as being more perfect, more real than this imperfect world that we actually live in, this ordinary world, which contains objects which are copies, poor copies of the perfect forms that live in this mysterious higher realm. Of course, as we mentioned before, this gets translated across into Christianity, which Nietzsche described as Platonism for the masses, where there's this better or higher world in heaven, or even perhaps in contemplation, there is something available. There's a deeper truth available to us, and of course, these structures, Buddhism and yoga. It's a structuration that we find in the East as well as the West. You'll even find it in shamanism, even, you know, the idea that there's this higher world up out of the smoke hole of the yurt, way off up there in the sky where the sky gods live, or where the ancestors live, or Valhalla, or whatever. These are all variants on a real apparent distinction. Or a true world, apparent world distinction. And this, as we've mentioned, is a trope that structures very, very, very much thought, and has been around a long time. And that the whole of the Matrix hinges on this real apparent distinction. The blue pill being the means of staying in the apparent world, and the red pill being the means of leaving the apparent world and inhabiting in the real world. So the idea there is that our ordinary reality, our ordinary lived experience, is somehow unreal. And of course, this is Neo's thing. He has this intimation that there's something wrong with the world. As Morpheus says to Neo, he says, "Oh, you have this feeling, don't you? There's something wrong with the world." And this is, you know, this is the splinter in your mind, and this is the very thing which has driven Neo to become a hacker and to try and discover things and to follow the subterranean connections through the cyberpunks to eventually meet Trinity and eventually meet Morpheus, who he's heard rumours of. You know, this magic bloke Morpheus who can tell you about the truth of the Matrix. So this is metaphysics, you know. Metaphysics real apparent. When it comes down to epistemology, in other words, theory of knowledge, and questions around, well, how do we actually know anything? How do we actually know anything? This immediately becomes a question of how does data get inside us? Yeah, there's this notion that we recognise data and are able to process data and are able to see the truth inside ourselves. So that somehow data about the world has to somehow get in, has to get inside us. Yeah, because there's no hope of any kind of true knowledge. There's no hope of having a red pill scenario in our lives unless somehow truth can be recognised within ourselves. And so the whole question becomes a question of how does stuff get in? So, how does the data about the world find its way in front of the eye of our soul, you might say? And you can see, the minute you start thinking about, well, how do we know anything in a metaphysical sense, you know, do we know what's really real? Yeah, it's a metaphysical, epistemological question is, how do we actually know anything about the really real, rather than the apparently real, you know? So, you then have to try and understand how the human being relates to the world. And you then immediately have a notion of the inside and the outside, of the subject and the object. And the subject being the eye, the thing which receives the data, and the object being that which supplies the data. And then of course there becomes the means of communication, the sense organs, the way in which the data gets in, the orifice, if you like, between this inner and outer. And this is actually like a way of looking at the human being as though the human being was a camera obscura, as though the subject, the eye, was like a little homunculus sitting at the back of a room, a darkened room, in which there's a blackout curtain over the window, but with a little pinhole just in the centre of the blackout curtain. And if you actually do that, you'll find that the light gets in and it produces an image of the world on the back wall. And you can stand there and you can see it, and you actually get an inverted image of the world. That's the famous camera obscura, which is used by artists in the Renaissance, but which was known to the Greeks and possibly even known way back in the Neolithic times, perhaps through when people lived in tents, for instance. They might well have come across this phenomenon. So you've got this metaphor for the human being as being like a camera obscura, with a subject homunculus receiving the data and doing the knowing. So you then get different ideas about the interface. Actually, what is the nature of the pinhole? What's the nature of the interface? Well, for somebody like John Locke, it's just it is a blank screen to start with. And a child is just a tabula rasa, just a blank screen. And the data gets in, and it's only by accruing experiences that sense is made of the data. We start to know what to call things, because we learn language and so forth. But basically, the Lockean view is essentially that the interface is relatively simple, and the only addition to the process made on the subject side is that knowledge is interpreted, data is interpreted and becomes knowledge in the light of experience, but that the child starts off as a tabula rasa. Now for somebody like Kant, there's rather more happens at the interface, the whole kind of complex of stuff happens at the interface, in which space and time and causality and so on are added to the process for us to make sense of it. I suppose in the 20th century we started thinking about further additions that were to do with culture and to do with gendered subjectivity, for instance, and with quirks of personal experience, providing an addition to the process at the interface between the outer and the inner, between the subject and the object. Right, and again, the linguistic turn says that language is very, very formative. We can only understand what we have terms for. Or we can only structure raw experience if we have narratives with which to structure it, and so on. So there's all the stuff about structuralism and post-structuralism and the linguistic turn and so on. They're actually all variants on this Platonic camera obscura. And somebody like Richard Rorty called this the ocular metaphor. It's also sometimes known as representationalism. Because the problem is, how is the world represented within us to the subject? So that's metaphysics. That's, one way of looking at metaphysics when you take a bit of an epistemological slant on it and you try and figure out how it is that we know anything. Now, obviously, the idea that there's an addition to the data from the world, that there's some kind of processing of the data from the world before the subject gets to understand it, is precisely what's underneath the red pill, blue pill conundrum. And it's perhaps thought that it's that addition. That places us in a state of illusion, and then you get the hope that somehow the doors of perception can be cleansed, as black porridge, you know, that there can be some kind of naked seeing without this addition, and that will somehow be more true. I mean, it could be that what happens when that happens is that you just get this formless swirl, formless abstract swirl. So you can see how that metaphor structures thought, you know, when we try and get some kind of second order thought about who we are, where we are, what metaphysically obtains around the self and the world, and the relationship and the interaction between the self and the world. But you're immediately in this ocular metaphor, and you're immediately in this real world, apparent world distinction, and structure the entire thing. In Plato, of course, we have the famous myth of the cave, in which he tells a story which is meant to capture what human knowing is and how it works. Plato envisages subjects as being chained up in a cave, and they're only able to face one direction, and they're actually looking at a shadow play on a wall, and that they take to be the world and the drama of the world and the drama of human life. Actually, how these shadows come about is that behind the chained subjects, there's like a walkway or a gallery, and there are some actors walking along backwards and forwards on that. They can't be seen by the subject because they can only face towards the wall. Behind the actors, there's a huge fire. So the light of the fire projects a shadow play on the wall. That for Plato was the apparent world that we live in. The real world, of course, is the entire situation. And you can see, the metaphysical view is the one in which you try and capture the entire situation and figure out how it is that things appear how they appear, even though they are not how they appear. So it's a metaphysical project of getting behind the veil. And for Plato, some people occasionally find some way of getting out of the chains, and they are able to describe the entire situation. They become metaphysicians or philosopher kings. They perform the semantic ascent through contemplation, through rationality, through trying to reason out what actually is going on here. And they perceive the entire situation. They see the fire, the actors, the shadow play, and the state of these chained beings. And of course, these are exactly analogous to the human beings who are being used as batteries in the Matrix. The human beings in their pods. The pod is the cave. You know, the brain in the vat is the modern cave, the modern Platonic cave. And of course, it produces real apparent. You know, in the modern scenario, the shadows are produced by electrical stimulation of the brain from a mainframe computer that convinces us that we're in a real world, but really it's a simulation. Yeah. Now, there is another quirk to the Plato story, in that Plato says actually there is a mouth to the cave. And if somebody gets free of the chains, not only can they describe the situation here on inside the cave in its totality and get a more total picture over and against the partial picture of those who are still in the Matrix, then you can actually walk out the cave and see the sun, and see the light of the sun. And the sun is likened to the ultimate form, the ultimate perfect form, the form of all forms, the good, which in Christianity, you know, in Christian theology, Neoplatonic Christian theology, becomes like God. Yeah. So, and the sun is this form of the good, the divine, and it's incredibly dazzling. And that is even outside the cave. So you get an even bigger picture. You've penetrated another layer of the veil. Of course, we see that in the Matrix, when Neo starts off on the quest to actually find, you know, to get to the mainframe, to change things, to liberate humanity, to find the architect and all the rest of it, you know. To find the, yeah, so. So there's this other level. Plato adds this wrinkle that if anybody escapes from the challenge and they comes back and then they try and tell everybody else, they won't be impressed. It'll be impossible to get them to believe. You know, you'll just sound like an idiot, just burbling, because they haven't seen it and it's so outside of their experience that they won't believe it. They just won't believe it. And so, you can see that the matrix and the real apparent distinction in the matrix is really is a direct echoing of the myth of the cave, Plato's myth of the cave. And I'm pretty sure the Wachowski brothers are just totally alert to the resonances and are very self-consciously using them. Another resonance, I mean, and there are loads, I say the entire tradition is laden with this real apparent distinction. And I would like to revisit it in the light of nature gives us a history of it. And it's very, very interesting, but that'll have to be at a later date. And another instance of real apparent and camera obscura metaphors is just the case of Descartes and the meditations of the 16th century. And René Descartes tried to put knowledge on a firm footing, and he thought the way to do that was just to doubt everything. And so he did a thought experiment, which he calls a meditation, and imagines that an evil demon would deceive him about everything. He thinks he has a body, but no, that's the deception of an evil demon. He thinks he lives in a world and moves around in it with rooms and girlfriends and shopping trips and time spent in the study doing maths and all the rest of it. But no, that's all an illusion created by an evil demon. Of course, the evil demon is exactly analogous to the computer program that's stimulating the brain of the humans in the pods in the matrix and producing the simulation, the virtual reality, the simulation, the matrix. And Descartes doubts in the hope of finding something he can't doubt, and in the belief that something he can't doubt would be the basis for sure and certain knowledge, grounded knowledge. I mean, this project's called Foundationalism. And again, you can see it's metaphysical, this kind of reliance on the internal, external. But what he does, he doubts all objects over and against subjects, even interior objects, even his feelings and his intuitions and all the rest of it. He believes that, well, the evil demon could actually be producing these experiences as hallucinations. So, he carries on with this process, doubting and doubting and doubting, radical doubt. It comes to the point that he does believe that he finds something he can't doubt. That is himself. You know, the cogito, he comes out, you know, cogito ergo sum, I think therefore I am. He says that he can't doubt. And the trick there is with I think therefore I am, is that you think, well, if he doubts that, how can doesn't that even subvert even that little bit of certainty? Well, Descartes would say no, because doubting is a species of thinking, and even in doubting he's asserting in his being. So what Descartes's done there with the ocular metaphor is cut off the outside, he's cut off everything on the other side of the interface between the subject and the object. He's just cut it off, and he's allowed an evil demon to cut it off, you know, just as the electrodes in your brain in the matrix will cut off the actual perception, is that you're in this bath of vinegar or whatever it is, you know, this bath of amniotic fluid. So again, it's exactly exactly analogous. So Dicot's problem then is, because Dicot was actually like really, really interested in the outside world, and he wanted to do physics, he wanted to subject the outside world to measurement and to see if he could give mathematical descriptions of what happens in the world of physis. In other words, physics. He wanted to elaborate physics. And he had the intuition that physics could be mathematically expressed. And of course, Galileo was already doing this. You know, Dicot thought he had some insights which he could kind of really elaborate this new cultural move. It's something I had to be very, very careful about, because I mean, Galileo was dragged down into the cellar by the Inquisition and shown the torture instruments for doing this. The church didn't want people challenging their right to say what the truth is. Kind of people trying to figure it out for themselves. To the extent they were quite prepared to kill people who thought they would take it upon themselves to have that independence of thought. So Dicot had to be very careful. But of course, he's there with his "I think, therefore I am." This is the one thing the demon can't deceive him about. So how on earth is he going to re-establish the world? How is he going to get back out, as it were? How is he going to get out of that solipsism? And Dicot's answer, as I've said before. Is to appeal to God. And he says, well, the only reason I know that my experiences are reliable is that God wouldn't let me be deceived, because God is good. So he then does have to kind of prove the existence of God, and he goes through the standard proofs, the ontological proof, cosmological proof, whatever, or variants of these known proofs for the existence of God, and that God gave him reason, and if he uses reason properly, he will be able to ascertain the truth. But he has to use it properly, and you can see in this equation, using reason properly is a moral duty, because it's God-given. Yeah, it's not only is it like you've just got to be technically proficient; it's a moral duty. And we get another example there of how truth-telling is an imperative. And when we talk about nihilism at a later date, we'll trace out how truth-telling as a moral imperative leads to an actual deconstruction, a self-deconstruction of theology and religion, and the gradual secularisation of society from Dicot's time onwards can actually be traced down to this self-deconstruction through regarding truth as a moral imperative of theology and the theological worldview. A process which incidentally made the space for mathematical physics. And that in a sense was Dicot's project. So there's another big resonance. You know, these are the big knobs out of the Western philosophical tradition. Plato, way, way back there in the before Christ, and Dicot there in the 16th century in Europe, France, and Holland. So all this from the blue pill, the red pill. So you can see how this is a kind of it's a scientific project, it's a religious project, this project of taking the red pill to twitch beyond the veil. It's a philosophical, purely metaphysical project, and now all these projects are meshed together. And you see it actually in the figure of Dicot. You know, he was doing theology because he needed God to make the whole system work, but had a project of making the world safe for mathematical physics. And placing knowledge in this philosophical way on a firm foundation. So there's a big project to twitch behind the veil with all kinds of ramifications. To twitch the veil aside and have a look. Or if you like, to get free of the chains in the cave and suss out the situation and then actually go out the mouth of the cave into the great light of the sun.
Yeah.
And you can see how so many human aspirations have just plugged into this whole, this drama, you know, of the deeper truth being revealed. Of course, science did it by trying to extend the senses with instruments. We've mentioned Galileo, you know, who spotted the rings of Saturn and the moons of, I think, yeah, the moons of Saturn. He's able to see them through his telescope, extending the range of the senses, and that is also moving out into bigger scales, bigger and bigger scales. And now in the 21st century, we're looking back thousands and thousands of millions of light years with our instruments as we go into become more and more appreciative and discover more and more of the vast size of the universe. That in a sense is a kind of a piecemeal twitching the side of the veil. And at the other end of the extreme, going down to smaller scales through the microscope. And of course microscopy wasn't too far behind these developments. And early pioneers, particularly Dutch lens grinders, Leeuwenhoek and so forth, were seeing the microbes in the tartar off their teeth and stuff like that, you know, and sperm swimming around in seminal fluid and stuff.
Yeah, it must have been an amazing moment.
It must have been, yeah, by extending the senses downwards, and downwards to molecules, and downwards to atoms, downwards to electrons, downwards to quarks, you know. Where does it end? Where does it end? Where? Let's twitch aside another veil. The Higgs boson, let's twitch aside another veil. Yeah. Dark matter, oh yeah. And our science itself is plugging into this real and apparent distinction, and but with a particular hope of extending the senses with instruments, but also of utilising mathematical descriptions, Descartes project, you know, finding a mathematical language for describing aspects of the world, such that predictions can be made. And hypotheses tested through quantitative experimentation. This is all in there. It's all in there. Anyway, it's going to get a bit noisy up here, isn't it?
Yeah, we're passing quite a lot of noisy things today, unfortunately. Yeah. Do you want to say a little bit about what you want to do in the next episode?
Well, in the next one, I want to relate it to politics and spin and ideology.
Yeah.
And culture, because you know, there's this. The Matrix is also a political film, and it's unashamedly a political film. It makes the point that it's a political film, particularly at the end. That passage at the end of the first film, you know, where it takes a look at modern, at late 20th century advanced society, and says, well, what's really happening here, you know? What's really going on?
Yeah.
How much of your mind, what is being pulled over your mind to keep you from the truth?
Yeah.
Well, advertising, ideology, notions about what a woman's supposed to be, what a man's supposed to be, notions of race, notions of nation, and all these kind of stuff. Notions of class and what your place is in the world, notion of how the world ought to work. The whole Marxist question is, well, why do slaves acquiesce in their slavery? Because his answer is because their real situation is mystified, because the powers that be, those that profit from this slavery, cast a veil over people's minds by controlling the information and the stories that the people get and digest, and which become integral to their slave personalities. That question, how does ideology work?
Okay. It's actually starting to rain now, so we must stop because our recording equipment's getting wet. But that sounds good. Anyway, I hope that was useful for everybody, and we'll speak to you again soon.
Yeah. Thanks for listening.